Imagine you and some friends are going to play a new card game. Maybe something like Uno or Cards Against Humanity if you're feeling frisky. You and your friends have never played this game before. So what's the first thing you do? Well, if you're like me, you read the instructions and the rules. You start learning how to play the game, what's allowed, how the game proceeds, how points get scored, what constitutes winning. Then, once you've learned the rules in theory, you probably play some practice rounds to put the rules to work. Now that everyone understands the rules and how to play, you can finally get down to playing a quote-unquote real game. Now, what if meetings worked that way? What if we acknowledged that we'd never had this particular meeting before? This meeting with this agenda, this objective, this group of people in this place at this time. It's never happened before. What if the beginning of the meeting was focused on making sure everyone knew how to participate? What if it allowed people to express their needs and request accommodations so that they could fully participate? What if we took things slow at the beginning so that by the time we got down to brass tacks, we felt confident that we were really working together on the topic at hand? What could happen if we disrupted assumptions about how we communicate and work together? I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show that rethinks work, business, and leadership for the 21st century economy. This is the final installment in my series on decoding empathy. So far, we've covered some new ways to understand what empathy is, how empathy can facilitate recognition, what empathy can teach us about creating more accessible social spaces, and how empathy plays a key role in copywriting. Today, we'll reimagine the practices, systems, and norms of communication at work to help more people feel seen and heard. Now back to meetings for a second. Meetings, love them or hate them, they're part of the human experience. We have meetings with family members, colleagues, and civic leaders, although hopefully not all at the same time. And depending on your life and work circumstances, there is a good chance you have frequent meetings. Maybe you even have a meeting or a few today. So it might sound ludicrous to compare a meeting to a game you've never played before. And maybe it is. It's more of a thought experiment than a policy recommendation. But it's also true that we tend to assume a lot more than we should when it comes to communicating and working with other people. Some of those assumptions are products of dominant culture. Here in the US, for instance, that probably means assuming that we should aim for objectivity, avoid conflict, and act with urgency. Those assumptions stem from capitalist and white supremacist values, and they make it harder for people who did not grow up with those values to fully participate. Other assumptions might be products of our bias toward sameness. Today's work culture has done away with the other. Instead of encountering the other as fundamentally different from me, I'm encouraged to perceive other people as the same. Or I'm encouraged to ignore the unfamiliar in my midst and create my own bubbles of sameness. Now, maybe this idea of a bias towards sameness might seem odd, and there are a couple of reasons. First, what's wrong with seeing everyone as the same? Aren't we supposed to learn to stop seeing race, sexuality, gender, or disability? Isn't that how we learn to treat each other equally? No, it's not. Sebane Selassie puts it this way. although we are not one, we are not separate. And although we are not separate, we are not the same. Sameness is not the same as equality. Sameness can't process what makes you and I think and feel differently. Sameness doesn't leave space for our whole humanity. Now, the second way that asserting a bias towards sameness might seem odd is that we have more access to different kinds of people from different cultures with different life experiences than ever in our history. With the internet and digital social networks, we should be awash in others and tuned in to difference. And some people are. But as a general rule, people use the internet to experience sameness. Our total interconnection serves instead to allow us to pass over those who are unfamiliar. Our horizon of experience becomes ever narrower, argues theorist Byung-Chul Han. All right, back to meetings. When meetings operate on assumptions, they encourage sameness. Everyone is expected to adhere to a set of rules or habits that someone else assumed was the best way to do things. If people in the meeting have different needs or experiences, they have a harder time participating because they have to conform to the same. Meanwhile, sameness also produces more sameness. In other words, status quo meetings lead to crappy status quo ideas. Now, I'm talking about meetings here because they're a very visible and nearly universal example of how the assumption of sameness makes working together hard. But really, when I say meetings, I mean any kind of communication between two or more people. At work, at home, at school, at town hall. The presumption of the same makes it all more challenging. So what does it take to invite the other in and create a space where they can participate?
The purpose or one of the functions of nonviolent communication is to actually create space to be able to name and to have conversation around needs.
That's Leonie Smith, founder of The Thoughtful Workplace.
I really am about supporting people who come from traditionally and historically marginalized populations to show up in their full humanity. And that's in the places that they live, they work, and they play. And I have a particular interest in having that conversation within Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities, but it's also true of any other marginalized folks. So that could be people with disabilities, LGBTQ plus folks, and other marginalized groups. And so what I'm about is bringing like practical skills that are through the narrative of principles of nonviolence so that people have practical ways of being able to attend to impact as it shows up in their day-to-day life so that they can show up more fully.
Nonviolence. We're going to spend most of this episode talking about nonviolence, either explicitly or implicitly. But before we do, let's look at the violence embedded in the assumption of sameness. Now, Byung-Chul Han argues that the other has been driven out of modern culture, and that's other with a capital O. He says that the sort of possibility and wonder of the other has been replaced by the violence of the same. By expelling the other, we not only do violence to the other, but we also do violence to ourselves, castigating our own differences, needs, and desires to better conform to sameness. Now, the tools and practices of nonviolence can help us welcome back the other for other people and for ourselves. So, what is nonviolence?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to define nonviolence, but for me, the thing that I'm really trying to lift up is how can we touch into our own humanity and that of other people so that we can really foster connection and create this the experience of both being heard and also to hear other people.
And nonviolent communication, as Leonie said earlier, is a set of tools and practices for helping us understand our needs and others' needs so we can work together better.
So the thing with nonviolent communication at the core of it is this understanding that there is a universal set of human needs. You know, primary in that set of human needs are things like having a sense of belonging, having the experience of being heard and received, those kinds of things. But also things like safety and connection and love, those are all there. What's invited within nonviolent communication is for people to think and reflect on what am I actually needing in this moment, and then to make your request from that space. And then in terms of like within families or within teams or organizations, there are ways that you can kind of have tools, like for example, around collaborative decision making, that type of thing, that are also about surfacing needs so that you're actually having a conversation about things that are much more meaningful and that are more focused on not only the transactional pieces, like how to get what I want, but how to get what it is that I need with some sense of like building relationship and having connection.
Today, what we know as nonviolent communication, or NVC, was developed by a clinical psychologist named Marshall Rosenberg in the 1960s and 70s. It grew out of a combination of person-centered therapy and social psychology. NVC has been used as a tool for interpersonal relationships, workplaces, and social justice movements. There are four elements to practicing nonviolent communication: observations, feelings, needs, and requests. By using these four elements, I can, quote, clearly express how I am without blaming or criticizing, and clearly express what would enrich my life without demanding. On the flip side, I can learn to receive your observations, feelings, needs, and requests without hearing criticism or blame, and learn what would enrich your life without understanding it as a demand. Ideally, nonviolent communication leads to 1, a better understanding of my own needs, 2, a better understanding of what you need, and 3, more open and honest expression. The Center for Nonviolent Communication talks about the process as empathy in action because it encourages participants to receive the other on their own terms while also encouraging participants to express themselves on their own terms.
Yeah, so oftentimes when I'm working with people, they are trying to connect to something that's really meaningful and they're unable to do so. It could be because that they're in conflict or they're not sure how to make space for themselves, or they're not sure how to support an atmosphere where they can be heard and listened to. And so what I want to work with them on is to be able to make room for more of the things that show up. So oftentimes we move to like labels like people are shy or they're not assertive, etc. And so what I'm interested in doing is in checking that out, actually, by going in with a sense of curiosity about what's actually coming up for you. Like it could be touching on previous experiences. It could be that you have an experience or a story in your head that there isn't room for you to exist in a particular relationship. And so we kind of touch on that, and using tools and principles of nonviolence and some tools and practices from nonviolent communication, we try to extract what's really meaningful and then start to look at how to create possibilities to move forward.
Leonie told me about supporting a client who felt like they were being dismissed or excluded from sharing their ideas.
In our conversation, in terms of the coaching piece, what was discovered was that this person did not have a way of being able to create or support the kind of container that would welcome her expression, because she was in a culture where there were certain people who were able to speak and be heard, and they had certain characteristics, things that get amplified in organizational cultures, like assertiveness or even like speaking loudly, that kind of thing, that did not come naturally to her. She wasn't habituated in that way. So then the way that I supported her in attending to that was, one, to touch into that she did have things to share that was meaningful, that she wanted to really create the opportunity to be able to share that. And then we started to talk about then, what are your needs that you would like? How would the container be different in order to support you in being able to express yourself more fully? And then we went to the place of, how can you then make that request to the group, to the team that you're sitting in? So in that case, some strategies were for her to say at the top, when she was about to share something, I have something to share, but I'm not exactly sure how quickly I can share it. So would you allow me just to say what I have to say to the point that I'm complete, and then to give me your feedback just to help me to get it out? So that kind of like really highly practical way of being able to engage. And so she found some success with that, because she just basically asked for the container. She wasn't trying to change the culture. It was just like, in order for me to participate, I would like these things. Are you willing to do those things? And when she got a yes, then that supported her in being able to express herself more fully.
In a culture that values sameness, making a request like that can feel awkward, even risky. People who make requests for accommodation are often seen as high maintenance or needy. But those judgments are consequences of others denying their own needs and avoiding making their own requests. Those judgments are part of the violence of sameness.
We often feel like it's too awkward to make those kinds of requests. And it's true, you can make those kinds of requests and it could land without interest with the people that you're with. But more often than not, people are willing to, you know, make an accommodation in order to support you in feeling more fully heard. And so people just get stuck on the words, and they also may not have the lived experience of being able to ask for space in that way. And so that's where the practices are really helpful.
Leonie has another great example of how this can work in practice. In white Western workplaces, it would be common for there to be an assumption that people take turns talking in a meeting. Seems pretty straightforward, right?
I come from a Jamaican family. Even though I'm born and raised in Canada, in the context of my family and the culture that I come from, that's like ridiculous. No one takes turns. It's just like not a thing. Can teams find ways to be able to welcome different types of expressions?
To put that another way, how can we reimagine practices, systems, and norms to allow more people to participate? There is no norm that can't be denormalized. So how could we design new ways of collaborating and working together that encourage the inclusion of others?
Another thing that comes up is, like, in some cultures, if you ask somebody a question, you get a story. Like, it's very much a storytelling narrative way of speaking that doesn't necessarily fit within an organizational context that's often about being concise with our words and being brief, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm really wanting to welcome for those who have different ways of communicating that maybe are not typical of the dominant culture is to invite the culture to welcome different types of expressions.
All right. So if you're thinking the logistics of this are starting to seem a bit overwhelming, I can assure you, you are not alone. Are meetings supposed to just become a free-for-all? How do we manage this equitably? After all, one person's form of expression might make it harder for someone else to express themselves. Do we just need to have endless patience?
What that means is not just like to have patience, because it's going to create impact. If you're in a culture that's used to brief, concise ways of speaking, and you have somebody who is more on the narrative storytelling side, then what that means then is that for people who are perhaps facilitating the space, that they have to hold some care for the impact that someone is going to take a longer time speaking, that the group is going to be impacted. So you're not only making way, but you're also managing the impact, because ultimately you're trying to not only just explore ideas, but also to foster connection. So for example, if you have somebody who takes more time speaking, as a facilitator of that space, I want to support that people to express themselves in a more natural way, but I want to also manage the impact, as I said before. What I might say to the person who's speaking is, I'm going to interrupt you from time to time just to recap what you're saying. What that does is that it helps to slow down that person, but it also helps a group to keep attention, because as a facilitator, you're helping to pick out the important points of what's being expressed. So both the person gets to more fully express and the group gets support in getting the information that it needs in a way that works better for that group. But then there also might be limits, for example, that I need, like a timekeeping limit for the person who is speaking and using like a lot of words or in the narrative piece. And so I want to think about that. And there are ways of being able to do that that are connecting and ways that are the disconnecting. And what I mean is support the relationship and doesn't support the relationship. So I could do things like have like a timer beep or go off to be like your 2 minutes are up. Not the nicest thing to happen. Or I could do something like say to the person or say to everybody, we're going to probably have in this round, for example, or gathering these answers, maybe we have maybe 2 minutes for each person to speak. What's the best way that you want me to let you know? Is it a knocking of the pen? You know, are you okay with the timer going off? Should I raise my hand? What would support you? So then that way I'm in relationship with the person that is speaking and they can give me a sense of what would best work for them that would be less jarring. So it's all those kinds of things that kind of welcome just different ways of expressing and really widen our window of tolerance to like what is normative behavior.
Widen our window of tolerance when it comes to what is normative behavior. In a recent post about declining an in-person speaking engagement, Devin Price shared how narrow windows of tolerance cause many people's typical behavior to fall outside of what's considered normal. For this reason, in-person events can be a minefield of potential shame and ridicule, including the potential for dire professional consequences. He wrote, "In the past, I have been reprimanded by academic advisors for the way I move and sit. When I have made the mistake of feeling at ease and moving and emoting in the ways that feel best for me, I have drawn stares and concerned questions about whether or not I was okay." Price is talking about in-person professional events here, but widening our idea of what's normal extends into any social space. For example, it's taken my husband and I years to learn that my normal behavior when I get overwhelmed or overstimulated is to shut down. I lose the ability to speak for all intents and purposes. He's also learned to accept that if we're going to have an emotionally challenging conversation, at least emotionally challenging for me, it's better for me to sit next to him, say in a car or at a counter, than to look directly at him. Importantly, I had to figure out that those were my needs before I could request that he accommodate them. And at least for me, it wasn't until I had opened my own mind to a wider window of acceptable social behaviors that I could grant myself the self-empathy to recognize those needs. A wider window of tolerance for quote-unquote normal behavior gives everyone involved the chance to identify and express their needs. And that can change everything. Of course, nonviolent communication doesn't ensure there's never a misunderstanding or that everyone's needs get met all the time. It's a process, not a magic bullet. So how do we check in and make sure that the process is working?
One thing is that our body will let us know. Our bodies and brains are really sensitive to stuff when things are off, right? And so it might show up in very obvious behaviors. For example, a person who there was like a certain flow of conversation and you find that that flow has slowed down, like they're being less responsive. That's like a pretty obvious sign that something is up. You may not know what that something is, but something. Or we might have a sense of, again, our body's telling us that something has shifted in the conversation. The other thing too is actually behaviors can get bigger. People can get louder. Oftentimes when people can't be heard, again, depending on what they're comfortable doing, they actually like make more noise. They use larger physical expressions, larger gestures, that kind of thing. So I would also look for like any kind of changes in like body language, the cadence of speech, that kind of thing. And then the difference, I think, with nonviolent communication is that one of the things that we share with people is how to check not only for understanding, but also for connection when you're in conversation with somebody. So when you're checking for understanding, that's where you often, for people who have taken nonviolent communication, we talk about like recapping, for example, right? Where you might like be like, is this it? Or this is what I'm hearing. You're kind of paraphrasing what's being said. But the check for connection, that if you're, for example, noticing that the flow has shifted or one of these other things, some kind of sense that you have that things have shifted, is to just be like, to acknowledge that, to like name the thing that's actually happening. Like, I noticed that when we started off this conversation, there was like a lot more flow and that things have slowed down. Could I just check to see whether or not there's anything else that you need to be different? Or, you know, have I missed a moment where I created impact? Just to like literally ask, like, you know, how are you doing? How are we doing in this conversation right now? And it's just a chance to interrupt the flow of conversation to see if there's any emergent needs that are coming up during the conversation.
As we started to wrap up the conversation, I asked Leonie what the name of her company, The Thoughtful Workplace, means to her. What is her vision for the thoughtful workplaces of the future?
For me, the key thing that I'm really focused on is I recognize that with or without intention, tensions will show up when we're working in organizational spaces because they are inherently human systems, but they're not set up around human needs. What I'm wanting is to support people in being able to raise their capacity to attend to those impacts. And so for me, when I think about the thoughtful workplace and how I arrived at that as a name and also as the thing that I'm doing, because so often relationships feel like they go off the rails, but they start off with small things that if there was just some tool or a practice to intervene, could have actually helped to save the relationship. So I'm really trying to support people in being able to attend to impact when it happens, both for themselves and for the people that they're connecting with at work. I have a strong belief that things can be better for people, even at work.
In the first episode of this series, I mentioned the French philosopher Simone Weil. In her notebooks, Weil mused on the idea that we read others and that we are read by others. By using the word read, she acknowledges that each and every one of us presents as a text, a medium through which we communicate who we are, what we know, and how we feel. Now, over time, we become speed readers. We build up a whole vocabulary of assumptions about who people are and what they mean when they communicate with us. We stop listening, stop paying attention, stop empathizing. The tools and practices that Leonie uses with her clients, the tools and practices of nonviolence and nonviolent communication, well, they help us to slow down. Our reading becomes less perfunctory and more intentional. We allow the other to be other and read them on their own terms. This, Weil says, is justice, to be continually ready to admit that another person is something other than what we read them to be, or to always remember that the other is certainly something different than what we read. Perhaps that also is the key to empathy, continuously reminding ourselves that whatever we think is happening for another person, The truth is something different. Empathy isn't the key to understanding someone else and their experience. Instead, empathy is a reminder that we must remain curious about and open to that which we can never fully understand. I hear echoes of Simone Weil in the way Byung-Chul Han describes listening. Listening, he writes, is not a passive act. It is distinguished by a special activity. First, I must welcome the other, which means affirming the other in their otherness. Truly listening allows the other to be themselves. It frees them for their otherness. And in this way, Han argues, listening can be profoundly healing. Leone invites us to listen, to remain curious, to increase our capacity for noticing the ways we read and are read create an impact on others and on ourselves. Not only can we create more thoughtful and just workplaces this way, but we can also transform our relationships and communities. Huge thanks to Leone Smith for sharing her time, expertise, and experience with me. You can find out more about Leone and The Thoughtful Workplace at thethoughtfulworkplace.com. While you're there, check out her Ask Leone video series, which offers practical, bite-sized ideas for navigating work relationships and culture thoughtfully and empathetically. If you've enjoyed the Decoding Empathy series and you want to support future work like this, please consider becoming a premium subscriber of What Works. For just $7 per month, you get access to exclusive content, quarterly live workshops, and more. Go to whatworks.fyi/subscribe to upgrade. That's whatworks.fyi/subscribe. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.